waiting for the other shoe to drop? On the next Mind's Eye Radio, it's hoofing it, or it's a really big shoe. We'll get to boogie a bit, take a look at an intergenerational conflict concerning walking in someone else's shoes, even hear what it feels like to actually be a shoe. That's hoofing it, or it's a really big shoe on the next Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor and the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him, who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? Those Winter Sundays by Robert Hayden. I cried because I had no shoes until I met a man who had no feet. The familiar chiding proverb tells us. There is wisdom here, yet most of us have both and don't give much time to thinking, much less talking about the fact. Lose thy shoe from off thy foot, for the place thou standest is holy. So saith Joshua, verse 15. Shod or unshod, today's Mind's Eye writers bring us back to earth, or at least near to earth, as they reflect on their patent leathers, swing their Romeos, give you the lowdown on the high tops, in Hoofin' It, or It's a Really Big Shoe.
During World War II, one of the most unheralded yet essential tools of victory in Europe was the merchant marine shipping industry. It is easy to forget that not only did we have to send men and women to fight the war, but we also had to keep them supplied. And at that point in history, supplies to Europe mostly traveled by ship. One of the more famous supply routes was the Murmansk route, supplying the USSR forces on the critical Eastern Front. While they were periodically escorted by naval vessels, often these escorts would be called away to active fighting. The result was that these sparsely armed ships were often sitting ducks for the wolf pack, the U-boat fleets. As a result, many, many merchant seamen gave their lives, along with massive losses of tanks, airplanes, fuel oils, ammunition, and K-rations. One figure that stands out for me is that the United States supplied the Russian front with over 15 million pairs of boots. 15 million! I uncovered this mind-boggling number while doing research on my ancestors who fought in the Norwegian resistance during the Nazi occupation. These Scandinavian resistance fighters were supplied by aerial drops from Britain, during which they also received American boots, but were generally unhappy with the soft pigskin construction. Whether or not the Russians liked our boots, I've yet to find out. But boots are important. Read any GI-inspired stories of war, and it is the topic of boots, mostly the lack of good boots, that comes to the forefront. Soldiers in Vietnam constantly battled wet feet and the accompanying foot rot. Civil War soldiers sometimes fought with rags wrapped around their feet. And no doubt Napoleon's army dreamed of better boots during its famous trek over the Alps. Think back to the war films we've watched on the big screen over the years. What's the first thing scavenged from dead soldiers? Their boots. Now myself, I have never been a soldier, but I have been and still am a carpenter. And when it's 10 degrees and snowing, you quickly learn the difference between a good pair of boots and a really bad attitude. And before I was a carpenter, I was a shell fisherman, digging clams from my boat in the Great South Bay off of Long Island in New York. Now, most people's idea of clam digging is wading the shallows and digging up clams with a pitchfork or a hand rake. This was different. We had long, flat-bottomed boats called Virginia Garveys, and we dug clams in 10 foot or more of water, using clam rakes with over 20 foot of aluminum handle. We dug clams all year round, even in winter when we would go out on the ice, cut slots with a chainsaw, and clam through the holes. Once, on an early gray spring day, I was out early. Because of the wind, not too many boats were working. In fact, there was not one boat in my section of the bay. The water around me still held the dark, slate gray of winter, not yet ready to give up on the idea of more ice. Occasional small coveys of ducks scooted low and hard across the tops of the waves, as if in a panic to find someplace warm. I liked being out on my own, no one jumping my spot. I had time to think, to grin, to shake my head at all the poor bastards stuck in an office all winter. Though I'd been known as kind of a cheapskate, that winter I had treated myself to a brand spanking new pair of calf-high, fleece-lined Norwegian fishing boots. These, along with my foul weather gear, kept the heat in and the wind out. That day the wind was coming out of the north, and I was working a particular ledge that I knew to be fruitful. But it seemed like the clams hadn't yet decided that winter was over and had buried themselves well below the teeth of my rake. A steady diet of waves lifted and dropped in my boat, and the bottom slapped the surface, sending out a fine spray that kept my face moist and salty. Then it happened. I was lugging up a rakeful of something, working the pole hand over hand, leaning back against the weight, when my footing went. Back I stumbled, rake in hand, and right over the opposite gunwale, head first. Now, winter foul weather gear is fine when you're in the boat, but get in the water with it on and it feels like a fear factor challenge. By the time I got to the surface, my boat was about 2 arms' reach away and drifting a bit faster than I. But I had hold of my $300 rake and damned if I would let it go. But my boots were also now full, so I knew I couldn't swim with both. I dumped the rake. I proceeded to half-breaststroke, half-frog-kick towards the boat, making painfully little headway. The next decision was more dire than the rake. Do I kick off my new Norwegian boots? My answer was to swim harder. The boat kept drifting. I was going down at the same rate as my body temperature. I finally kicked one boot off, and a few seconds later had flailed myself to the boat, managing to haul my wet butt over the gunwale, cursing the whole time for my lost boot. Amazingly, I got myself home that day, intact. But true to my frugal nature, I couldn't bear to throw away my remaining boot, and for years it sat in my closet next to all the other pairs of shoes and boots, like a lonesome single at a Valentine's party, waiting for its partner. Finally, though, I let go of that one saved boot. As far as the other boot, the one I lost in the bay, that one will take much, much longer to let go of. This is Guy Thorvaldsen from Mind's Eye Radio.
Writer Fran Rawl takes a practical approach to this necessary foot-covering business, no slave to fashion. She's been sensible her whole life.
From the time I was in high school, I've had trouble with shoes. Everyone else was wearing saddle shoes with pleated wool skirts and wool sweaters. I actually don't know why I can't remember wearing saddle shoes, but probably I did, as they were not much more expensive than ordinary shoes. But maybe it was because I couldn't wear wool that I skipped the whole thing. For more than 20 years, though, I was out of fashion because low-heeled shoes, broad in the toe, were all I could wear. A skiing accident left me unable to raise my heel much more than so much off the ground. So I can only remember one pair of high heels, black suede, which had a certain hazard built in. Wearing them for too long produced a cramp in my foot, which meant I had to have a rest. This isn't such a great date ritual. Pointed shoes were my real downfall. Heels got low, but toes got sharper. Since my feet are almost square across the toe, this meant getting shoes too long for me, which wasn't too swift either. After hearing me complain about shopping for shoes, my husband accompanied me once. I was used to such comments, but he became indignant when the clerk told me all he had that I could wear were old lady comforts. Well, I didn't wear them, and I didn't wear shoes which didn't fit. So I have pristine feet, if a bit odd in the toes, which is a boon as one grows older. And now you can wear any old shoes to a dance with a long skirt or pants. No one would even bother to notice. But you don't have to go to that extreme because low is the name of the game, not to mention broad. Reading about Chinese foot binding always makes me cringe. It's so sad. And I sort of felt sorry for women who wore shoes too tight and too high-heeled once I got past the age of envying them. Now I read about women on a certain TV show altering their feet so they can wear those hideously expensive Italian shoes designed by Manolo Blahnik. They don't carry them where I shop, so I've never seen a pair. I can live without seeing them, and I can certainly live without seeing a foot which has been altered. It's all too reminiscent of the ugly stepsisters of Cinderella, who cut off some toes so they could fit in the crystal slippers the prince brought around. This is Fran Rawl with Boring Feet Without Corns or Bunions, hoofing it for Mind's Eye Radio.
Calceus major subvertit, claims the Latin proverb. A shoe too large trips one up. An empire too large falls to pieces. A business too large comes to grief. An ambition too large fails altogether. While she did not actually trip, Norma Gay Pruitt understands the importance of finding a shoe that fits.
Spring brought mud to my little town. Mud, and that year, eighth grade graduation. All of which meant the need for curiously incongruous clothing, weatherwise. Frilly, white, confirmation-type dresses and high-pump heels. My family could ill afford new special dress clothes, but I was blessed, cursed is how I thought of it then, with three older sisters, all of whom had worn a frilly, white, eighth-grade graduation dress. One still had some wear in it by the time it got to me. My mother always reworked their prom and dance dresses, and this one would be treated the same. I would inherit somebody's starched can-can, the scratchy petticoat of the 50s and 60s that made a body look like a snow cone upside down. So this dress was predetermined, and I was resigned. But what I could not wear was their shoes. Not because of any finicky aversion on my part, such indulgence would not have been tolerated in my family, but because I had, and interestingly, still have, the tiniest feet one can imagine on an adult person able to stand up. Today, I wear a size 3, children's, occasionally a 4 in women's, though that size has practically ceased to exist. Then, I probably wore a 2.5, children's. But I was going to wear my first panty girdle and hose, as my mother called them, and I was not going to graduation in Buster Brown's. I had long harbored only the darkest thoughts about Buster Brown and his damned dog, Tige. In Keds and other gym shoes, as we call them in those plainer spoken times, I was fine, since kids' shoes, with bumpers, looked pretty much the same from cradle to grave. and my saddle shoes are penny loafers from Carp's, the only and sadly named department store in the next largest town in the county, were standard issue and didn't single me out as odd. Sure, people had noticed that my feet were extraordinarily little. Even in a family whose tallest member would achieve an impressive 5'6" height. But all of my sisters at that time, and the one younger, had grown at least a size 5s. It was I who got the stubs. Any aspect that sets one apart, even in a conceivably positive or cute way, from one's peers is anathema to a 13-year-old. I studied my friends' poodle skirts and short-sleeved pullover sweaters and tried to find the Carp's equivalents. So, the problem. Graduation loomed, and I worried and whined. My mother would have gladly shod me in the red rubber boots or the sling-back convertible strap patent plastic Easter shoes I had worn for years, but they did not have what I needed most, heels. In those days, manufacturers made what they called sample shoes, the ones they packed into salesmen's satchels to show for the new spring line. They were made tiny, 4s and 5s, so that ladies, looking at them, would imagine their own Cinderella stepsister feet, sparkling and petite in these miniature slippers. And they didn't stint on high, high heels, since they were never expected to be actually worn and walked in. There was such a thing as French heels at the time, but not in the sample shoe. The sample shoe, the ones that ended up in the display windows at shoe stores, where they would bleach out unevenly in the sun so that one would end up puce and the other a clear green, were like roller coaster rides in shape and steepness. They had very pointed toes, the devil's triangle toe that's back in style today. They were, in short, unwearable, and always in outrageous styles. But heels I had to have, and heels I would. My mother finally yielded to my pleading and shanghaied my sister Jeanette to drive to Rockford, the nearest town of any size. We prowled. Jeanette laughed at me. After all, she proudly strolled on size 5s, and I grew increasingly impossible as no shoes appeared that didn't walk off without me or show the crow's foot of my toes or hang out behind. It was late in the day, probably a Friday. Sister Jeanette had a date, no doubt, and was 30 miles from home. She didn't like me much on the best of days, and this was not it. Finally, a sample shoe appeared in tacky, whitish brocade that looked like, with the aid of Dr. Scholl's inserts to tighten the fit and a wad of Kleenex in the toe, it might serve. True to experience, one of the pair was yellowed from exposure to sun, but I could stand and take 8 steps before toppling, as I demonstrated to a delighted audience of shoppers in the plastic-smelling store. They were purchased after haggling for the discoloration factor and the bigger fact that nobody besides me and elves and dwarves could have purchased them at all. In the resultant pictures, I look, of course, awkward and ridiculous. I had to wear those increasingly dilapidated shoes, which attracted mud and unremovable stains like cheap suits do lint, for every occasion for the next 4 years. I even have a faint memory of trying to dye them fuchsia for some hot dance. I repress how badly that worked out. But I hobbled across the stage, seized my roll of paper, collapsed in the folding chair, and maybe had to be carried home for all I know. But damn it, I wore heels. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, graduate from Mind's Eye Radio. Thank you.
Shoes, no matter how fancy or plain, are for wearing on the Tootsies, right? Well, not necessarily so, at least not in the hands of performance artist John Morgan, whose Uncle Norm shows little Jimmy a thing or three about versatility.
Sing for your supper and you'll get breakfast, songbirds always sing. Let's see now. I got coat hangers, carpet tacks, screws, and this pair of shoes when he won't need any more. I'll just bend this coat hanger here.
Uncle Norm, what you making there?
I'm making a bird, Jimmy.
A bird? It looks like a pair of shoes to me.
It is a pair of shoes right now, but in a few minutes it'll be a pair of birds.
Oh, yeah? You're kidding me.
No, really. You want to see how to do it?
Sure. I'll believe it when I see it.
Okay. Notice these are high-heeled shoes. If you hold one up, you can see it looks like a bird without legs. See how the heel is the beak and the toe is the tail?
Wow, Uncle Norm, you're right.
So all we have to do is make it some legs, eyes, and a tail. We make the legs by twisting your coat hanger into a leg with a five-toed foot. We screw the legs on, stick in some carpet tacks for eyes, and then all we need is a tail.
But what do you use for a tail?
That's the beauty of it, Jimmy. You can use whatever you want. Every time you change the tail, you make a different bird. See how these are open-toed shoes? You stick the tail right in that opening.
Oh, yeah. I see how it works.
Okay. I got these legs made now, so I'll just screw them on here.
So how many tails do you have?
Oh, I got about 18 now. I got two birds that are a pair. One has five folded dollar bills for a tail. The other has a small bouquet of flowers. The female is the one with the money. The male has the flowery tail. They are bar rail birds, a rare subspecies of the rail bird. They make their nest among clumps of beer bottles and lay hard-boiled eggs in them. They'll buy you drinks for the tail feathers, and their plumage grows back on payday.
What are you two doing?
We're making birds, Aunt Winnie.
Norm, do you have to put silly notions in that child's head?
What you going to do with that feather duster, Uncle Norm?
Well, we'll just stick it in the toe here, and there's a crop duster bird. Got a whole bag of tails here.
Gee, what other birds you got there?
Norm, I was planning on wearing those shoes next week.
Well, I got a blue fly swatter. That makes a blue-tail flycatcher. Here's a pair of scissors. There you have a scissor-tail swallow. And there's a penny whistle. What else would that be but a flute of the loon? You blow up this long balloon, and there you have a bar loon.
Norm, those shoes are still good. I just bought them last year.
Then you have a cigar. That makes a puffin. Now then, we have a couple of ballpoint pens. You fasten the clips over the sides of the shoe to make a pen wing. And what do you think this paring knife is for? Stick the handle in the opening, and there you have a butcher bird.
Norm, I need to talk to you.
Honey, can you get me a beer while you're up? Now here we have five drinking straws. You stick them in there, and you have a swallow. Then you take five birthday candles, stick them in the ends of the five straws, light them up, and there you have a flamingo. There are a few more birds, but those are the main ones. You can make up your own.
Boy, Uncle Norm, I'm going to go home and make some birds, too.
Well, you can try this at home, Jimmy, but be sure and ask your mom first. See if she's got an old pair of shoes she doesn't need anymore.
Oh, I know she does. I've seen them in the closet.
Goodbye, Norm. I'm going shopping.
Uncle Norm, you been eating birdseed?
These scenarios are featured in the website dangling.com. Filmed by a shoe play enthusiast who understands the sexual allure of dangling shoes. In this scene, Sandy is enjoying a day on the patio with a friend. See her casually engaging in shoe play. Her shoe dangles off the end of her toes. She manipulates it to swing and sway until she finally loses control and the shoe falls to the ground. Now, she has to feel around with her foot to locate it again. Or this scene. Julie is seated at her large executive desk. Under the desk, we can see that she is engaging in some sensual shoe play while she conducts her daily business. Julie's right foot slides in and out of her cream pump, and her toes gently ply the edges of the shoe as she fumbles to get it back on her foot. Or this scene. Christina is getting ready for work, but she just can't decide on what shoes to wear with her outfit. Will it be the black pair, the beige, the red? She tries shoe after shoe on, slipping her pretty feet gently into and out of each pair. The shoes start to pile up, but Christina still cannot make up her mind. Or this scene. Susan's feet are tired and hot from a day in nylons and runners. She takes a break to give her feet a breather. She massages them with her hands and then uses her toes to massage along the arches of the opposite foot. Jacqueline Whittune takes this shoe business one step further by imagining what it might be to actually inhabit the soul of a shoe.
Provided I were a shoe, I would be a running shoe, running as fast as I can before opportunities flash by. Were I a fruit, I would be a banana, sweet and cheery, tearing down each peel slowly, but insecure and tender, once you get to the middle. A dessert, chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream, many pieces collaborating to generate my different flavors. Were I a machine? A printing press, never stopping, working like a ferocious animal until I'm exhausted. A plant? A flower, budding and blooming with each drop of knowledge. Were I a season? Spring, not smoldering, but brightness, fluffy like cool white clouds. Were I a tree? An immaculate, full evergreen, standing strong against the vindictive, prickly winds of the seasons. Clothing, inviting black midnight fleece pajama pants, burrowing away, reflecting and hibernating. Were I anything, anything at all? A wall, listening intricately as I cling to my concrete body and discover the zillions of revelations among the spaces. Were I a drink? Hot, spicy chai latte, warm and open to life's rich adventures and escapes. A color? Gold. Delicate and priceless, being wanted by everyone at one time. An organ? Heart. Sturdy, yet fragile. Abundantly sharing my resources. Provided I were a shoe, I would scramble up hills and immense mountains, gripping every grain with each stride. This is Jacqueline Whittune for Mind's Eye Radio.
She's a rich girl, she don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket. Empty as a pocket with nothing to lose. Sing ta-na-na, ta-na-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Ta-na-na, ta-na-na, she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. 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 Diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
Waiting for the other shoe to drop? Listen in for the second half of our show today, when we get to boogie a bit, take a look at an intergenerational conflict concerning metaphorically walking in someone else's shoes.
People say I'm crazy, I got diamonds on the soles of my shoes, yeah. Well, that's one way to lose these walking blues. Diamonds on the soles of my shoes.
Working people know the value of shoes. They can make your life misery if inappropriate for your task. But sometimes children suffer another side of shoe style experience, as poet Oscar Morales found out.
My father bought me a pair of brown wingtip shoes for my first day of junior high school. And since it was one of the first times I had shoes that cost more than $1.99, I was so excited that I walked on the school playground with them on. But the only one who noticed them was Pete V, who said, "Where did you get those shoes from?" And before I had a chance to answer, the bell rang, and I headed to class, with books in my hand and an embarrassed look hanging from my face. So, for the next 2 months, I would walk out of the small house on Hartman Court, where our family of 12 children live, stop on the bottom step of our front porch, reach along the bottom of the creaking stairs, grab a pair of raggedy tennis shoes from the year before, put them on, and gently place the brown wingtips in their resting place. When I got home from the cold and the snow, my tennis shoes were drenched. I would put on the brown wingtips after creeping on the stairs and walk inside as if nothing was wrong. One day, arriving home after junior high school wrestling practice, my father said, "See, a good pair of shoes lasts a long time." This is Oscar Morales for Mind's Eye Radio.
Spring comes to the city. One March night, the wind shifts southerly, and throughout the next morning the sun means it. Within hours, all the gray snow changes phase. Bubbles seep up through cracks in the sidewalk, as though mystery fish were waking, beginning to breathe. Downtown, grimy taxis and buses plunge through submerged avenues, splashing hugely. Graceless swimmers, they practice all day. On the wet walk, carefully dressed women pick their way feline in their precious and dangerous shoes. Inside boxes of shop window glass, bevies of tall plastic beauties in gauzy print dresses are holding their exquisite wrists in mid-flex and tilting their narrow hips into spring. This is Sharon Van Sluis for Mind's Eye Radio.
Thank you.
Perhaps nobody knows who invented shoes. It must have been one of those spontaneous, simultaneous inventions, since everybody knows what it feels like to walk or run or be chased over rough terrain on bare, tender feet. Shoes have been around so long that most of us, besides Imelda Marcos, the once reigning diva of footwear, don't pause long to look at them. But artists have always been known for noticing things the rest of us don't, including artists as different as Van Gogh and Andy Warhol. Poet Yala Corwin uses the medium of words to portray their portrayals. In Old Shoes by Van Gogh and Stardust Shoes by Warhol, her poems are read by Esther Cameron.
This poem is by Yala Corwin. It will appear in the next issue of the poetry magazine I edit, the Neo-Victorian, also known as Cochlea. Old Shoes by Van Gogh and Stardust Shoes by Warhol. Like a pair of patient dogs they gravely sit, soiled, battered, scuffed, as if they had been dropped from someone's tired feet and thudding hit the floor. They sit inert, and time seems stopped, letting us sense the odor of their sweat. Whose toil, whose pains, what agony they must have witnessed, Vincent's own despair, and yet there is hope, for sweat transcends the dust. Another age, another kind of vision picks up the theme, a pair of shoes, new laced, no feet have worn them, here no earthly scope. They float in space, drawn with great precision. What force has styled them so without a trace of human presence? No one here to hope. That was a poem by Yala Corwin, and I'm Esther Cameron.
Poet Esther Cameron captures the simplicity of this straightforward piece of apparel in two lyrical salutes.
Nothing is emptier than the shoes of someone who won't be back to put them on again. Your boots stand by the door of the farmhouse. They've waited silently all these years for your return. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
No, I am not going to pay to have your nose fixed, Carol said to her daughter, Ellen.
Writer Evie Thompson.
It looks perfectly okay to me. In fact, you got one of the better noses in the family. Ellen, who was back home after breaking up with her boyfriend, sulked on the sofa. All right, if you must know, I need it to improve my self-esteem. Look, you have large, lovely eyes and beautiful, tiny shell-like ears. Just concentrate on the good things. I'm not going to pay for this surgery, and in my opinion, you shouldn't either. But do what you think best. Carol went into her bedroom and changed into her shorts. While she was tucking in her shirt in front of the floor-length mirror, she glanced at her legs, and then looked back a second time. They were her mother's legs. Oh, my God! A photo of her mother flashed across Carol's mind. In the snapshot, Mom had just returned from her trip to Switzerland and was wearing those silly lederhosen. Knees locked, no curve in the thick calves that went straight to the floor, with only a hint of an ankle. I am becoming my mother, Carol thought. But I was never as much of a problem to Mom as Ellen is to me. To the contrary, Mom had always been critical and domineering. She could recall any number of times when that had been the case. For example, there was that time that Carol had dyed her hair. She remembered she'd been standing in her parents' living room with her dad. She had dyed her hair red, and Mom was in the bedroom, bawling loudly. "You did this awful thing, and you did it on my birthday!" "It's almost laughable," Carol had said to Dad, "to be making such a big thing out of just dyeing my hair." "It's not small at all," he'd said. "In my younger days, the only women who did that were called hennaed women. They were ladies of the night. So what do you think this looks like to us? What does it mean?" "Well, certainly not that. I just wanted to see how I'd look with red hair." At that time, it had seemed so simple and straightforward. Mom had been totally in the wrong, and she, Carol, had been in the right. But now, looking back, seeing it from a different perspective, it had been more than that. She had been searching for a more venturesome identity, letting the world know that she was no longer just a nice middle-class girl. And they, at some level, had known that and mourned it. In today's world, Carol's daughter Ellen would have had to pierce her navel and wear a ring in it to achieve the same effect. Carol was glad that Ellen had not chosen that particular way of defining herself. Carol was sure, though, that she had never been really hard on her parents. But thinking back now, there had been that one time. She and Mom had faced off. They had been in the breezeway at her parents' home, the jalousies partly open, a summer day. Carol could no longer remember what had precipitated the quarrel. "You don't love me," Carol had said, her 2 years of therapy firming her backbone for the accusation. "Of course I do. No one will ever love you as I have loved you." "You don't show it. What about all that money we spent putting you through college?" "Money isn't love," Carol had said scornfully. And then she had gone into the living room where she'd picked up her purse and put on her sweater. When Carol had arrived at her car, there had been a carton of a dozen eggs on the front seat. Mom got them at a special rate from a woman at her church. Carol had known that Mom put them there on purpose after the confrontation. Rage had boiled up in her. One by one, Carol had smashed the eggs onto the ground. Then she'd driven off, feeling triumphant because her therapist had urged her to express her anger, and she'd done that, and what's more, thoroughly enjoyed it. Well, that was a long time ago. They say you have to walk a mile in someone else's shoes to understand them, Carol thought. And here she was, walking in her mother's shoes. And they did pinch a bit. Carol's disagreement with her daughter, Ellen, had been painful. What patience it takes, she thought, to go on loving someone through it all. Because there was no doubt in her mind that she loved her daughter and that she would love her and stand by her no matter what she did. And then a realization struck her. Mom really loved me, she thought. My mother really did love me. Carol sank onto the vanity stool. Tears came, followed by a sense of peace that wrapped around her like an old familiar comforter. She sighed and laid her head on the cool glass of the dressing table. This is Evie Thompson from Mind's Eye Radio.
While millions of moms can't be wrong, and many of us have the foot problems to prove it, sometimes sensible is not the way to go, as Lynn Patrick Smith pleads in Sensible Shoes.
see someone dancing like a child. Not a waltz, but something wild. In control all the time, your shoes are not the dancing kind. They're not suede and they're not blue. Better kick off your sensible shoes. When I said let's twist again, you just couldn't feel the rhythm. Your shoes are comfortable. What good does that do you now? They're not suede and they're not blue. Better kick off your sensible shoes. Your life is full of facts, but you could use some fiction. Remember how we used to dance, raise a little mischief. It's been a while, I would guess, since you put on your party dress. You think your shoes are a perfect fit, but they're not made for a discotheque. And they're not suede and they're not blue. Better kick off your sensible shoes. You better lose your sensible shoes. You better lose those sensible shoes.
This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Shoe customs have a rich history. It was at one time thought unlucky to put on the left shoe before the right, or to put either shoe on the wrong foot. It's said that Augustus Caesar was nearly assassinated by a mutiny one day when he put on his left shoe first. Plucking off the shoe among the Jews, smoking a pipe together among the Indians, breaking a straw together among the Teutons, and shaking hands among the English are all ceremonies to confirm a bargain, now done by earnest money. Put on the right shoe first. One of the auditions of Pythagoras was this: when stretching forth your feet to have your sandals put on, first extend your right foot, but when about to step into a bath, your left foot enter first. Iamblichus says the hidden meaning is that worthy action should be done heartily, but base ones should be avoided. Well, that sort of puts the shoe on the other foot, doesn't it? I hope today's Mind's Eye Show helped you get off on the right foot. And in case we've missed any cliche concerning shoes and feet, ponder this: the shoe that fits one man pinches another. There is no recipe for living that fits all cases. That from Carl Jung. That's our show. Thanks for listening to Hoofin' It, or It's a Really Big Shoe. The Shoe, the show, was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski. Hoofin' It for Mind's Eye Radio today were Esther Cameron, Oscar Morales, John Morgan, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rawl, Lynn Patrick Smith, Evie Thompson, Sharon Van Sluis, and Jacqueline Wihun. Original music by Barbara Chusett. If you'd like a copy of the show or more information about Mind's Eye Radio, go to the website www.mindseyeaudio.com. Thanks for listening, and let me leave you with a couple of famous shoe salesman jokes. The first one, the apocryphal story of the two shoe salesmen who were sent to Nigeria to start a new shoe business. The first salesman immediately cabled back and said, "Get me out of this place. Nobody wears shoes. Impossible to start a new store." But the second salesman cabled back saying, "Send large shipment. Huge opportunity here." The second story is about a man who came into a shoe store and told the salesman, "I'm looking for some wingtips in 8.5. Well, the shoe salesman looked at his shoe and measured it and said, "Sir, 8.5 is way too small for your foot. You must wear at least a 10 or a 10.5. He said, "No, I want 8.5 and I want them now." And the man said, "But they're way too short and way too small. Your foot is broad and long." And the man insisted, "I want 8.5s and I want them now." So the shoe salesman went to the back and brought back the 8.5 wingtips and fitted them on. The man, in obvious pain, squeezed his foot into the shoe and hobbled around like he was crippled. The shoe salesman watched him with horror and said, "Sir, these shoes are way too small for your feet. I can see you're in pain." And the man said, "That's okay, just wrap them up." And he said, "Well, why do you want shoes that are so much smaller than your foot?" And the man said, "My wife is sleeping with my best friend. I'm losing my house. I just got fired from my job, so the only pleasure I have is taking these damn shoes off at night." A shoe salesman, was fitting a woman with a new pair of pumps. And as he was bending over, his tie got entangled in the back of the shoe. The woman didn't notice and got up and started walking around in the shoes, dragging the man behind him. The woman's friend looked down and said, "Oh, look, Martha, the shoe salesman wants to follow you home."